there are many services and infrastructures, roads, buildings that need to be restored so that everyone in the community can, in fact, return to a more secure and safe life.
And Margaret, have you received any response from the U.S. or the U.K. governments to your requests or your demands that they should be involved in reconstruction and also reparations should be paid to the survivors?
When we first presented some initial findings and cases to the U.S. coalition, actually during the war, we were told that these were anomalies and not, you know, isolated cases and incidents. That is why Amnesty felt encouraged to do this very in-depth investigation, and we've now determined at a minimum a conservative estimate of 1,600 civilians killed. We've been presenting our cases to the U.S. coalition, asking them to acknowledge them and to move forward with some form of restitution and reparations. To this date, the U.S. military has acknowledged 180 of our cases that we've identified. They have not yet started with any restitution or reparation, and there are hundreds more that we're waiting for them to acknowledge. I think what's very clear on the ground is that it wasn't isolated cases. There were hundreds and hundreds of buildings destroyed and hundreds of families lost. And I think it's in the best interest of the U.S. military, the U.K. military, and other members of the coalition to really learn from this experience in Raqqa. If they believe in their precision airstrikes as a tool for trying to protect civilians, they need to understand what actual impact happened in Raqqa, who was affected. And if they're not willing to do the investigations themselves, then they have to take the cases and the incidences that we've provided and others in order to determine how they can offer better restitution to families.
Margaret Hwang, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Executive Director of Amnesty International USA just returned from a trip to Raqqa in Syria. We want to wish Mike DeFilippo a happy birthday. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grundle's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more. Can you hear me? What's going on? You can't hear me at all? What the heck? Go right to this. What the heck? You can't hear me talk at all?
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m., at Gresham City Hall. Bodie Phelps was 22 years old when two Gresham police officers shot and killed him on May 24, 2016. The gathering remembers Bodie Phelps with speakers, flowers, candles, and protest against police murder. Again, that's Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall, 1333 Northwest Eastman Parkway, in Gresham. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
Hey, And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon senators throw the rules out and vote to pass reform to cut costs on retirement benefits.
And teachers rally to save their jobs, salaries, and retirement.
And as temperatures warm up, so does the debate about managing wildfires in Oregon.
The KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 23rd, 2019. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Oregon senators suspended rules to push a vote on Democratic leaders' plan to rein in public employees' pension costs. Senate Bill 1049 passed 16-12. Republican lawmakers made the difference. Two voted in favor of the bill, while two more were absent. The House has not scheduled its vote yet. The bill does not address the pension system's $27 billion deficit, and three-quarters of its savings come from extending the minimum payment schedule on the deficit by 8 to 10 years. The Oregonian reports almost all of today's debate focused on the bill's cuts to employee retirement benefits. The plan would redirect part of the retirement contributions employees make to a savings plan. Some of those contributions would go into an account that would support pension benefits. Oregon is only one of only two states that doesn't require employee contributions to its pension plan. The average pension contribution in states where employees are also eligible for Social Security, as in Oregon, is 6% of pay. A business-backed group has filed ballot measures that would require a 6% contribution. By reducing the money going into the supplemental retirement accounts, the plan would cut career employees' retirement benefits by 1 to 2%. Employees say they're already underpaid and argue the new plan could create the precedent for coming back and demanding more from employees if the pension fund deteriorates. Public employee unions say the plan is unfair and unbalanced and criticize lawmakers after the vote.
And Lisa, Oregon lawmakers have been grappling with the state's public employees' retirement system debt since the 2008 recession. As Eric Tegedoff reports, teachers gathered on the Capitol steps Wednesday to oppose the bill that would change the public employees' retirement system.
One of the biggest concerns for public employees about Senate Bill 1049 is it cuts money from PERS members' retirement accounts, resulting in a 7-12% reduction of that account. That bill moved out of committee on Tuesday. PERS has a $27 billion unfunded liability, and lawmakers have wrestled with the issue since the 2008 recession wrecked the state's economy. Lindsay Ray, a high school math teacher in Beaverton, says the constant calls for cuts to PER can be demoralizing.
The public perception of PERS and this kind of vilifying of public sector workers is really challenging when you're trying to break into the field and you want to be a public servant.
Ray says she loves teaching but also appreciates her great retirement benefits. She adds that public employees shouldn't be responsible for paying down investment losses from the recession a decade ago. Supporters of SB 1049 say it could save the state money in the long run. According to the Oregon Center for Public Policy, educators in the state earn about 22% less per week than their private sector peers. However, if benefits are factored in, that gap narrows to about 9% less. Patty Wentz with the PERS Coalition says it isn't fair to make public employees pay down a debt they didn't create. She says retirement benefits are a big incentive to be in the public sector, and notes that changes to PERS more than 15 years ago actually resulted in many public employees choosing to retire.
One of the problems that Oregon has is more than 30% of people who are in public service today are eligible to retire. And in 2003, when we had the big overhaul of PERS, we had double the retirements in 1 year, so it was a real problem.
Ray says teachers were excited about passage of the Student Success Act, which will raise $1 billion per year through a 0.5% tax on Oregon's wealthiest businesses. But now that excitement is dissipating.
It's kind of a slap in the face right after the governor signed the Student Success Act. Educators have been riding on this high, and it's just this kind of roller coaster of emotion to then turn around and have those very same supporters pull the rug out from under us on PERS.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A veteran of the Portland police resigned this week amid DUI charges. Stephen James Jones, the former head of the Bureau of Professional Standards, chose to resign in the face of potential discipline, which, according to his lawyer, could have included his firing. The 47-year-old Jones pled no contest to reckless driving and driving under the influence in Multnomah County Circuit Court. In December, Jones received a 3-month driver's license suspension and also agreed to pay more than $38,000 to cover the damage to the police SUV and the pole he struck. Jones will be eligible to start collecting his pension when he turns 50, but it will be calculated slightly below the full payout as he will have resigned about 5 months short of 25 years of service.
Today, a group of about a dozen people gathered outside the Multnomah County Courthouse in downtown Portland protesting what they're calling police brutality. KBOO's Kinsey Beard was there and talked to one of the group's leaders, Shalonda McNair. Here's part of their conversation.
My name is Shalonda McNair. I'm the mother of Adacia Miller. This is my daughter. And I'm also the president of Pulse, Protect Our Stolen Treasures. This is my Portland chapter. They asked me to come out and stand with them today on help them with this fight and just to show that we are a multi-state fight. We're fighting for our loved ones. They were killed by police officers. My daughter lost her life the day before her 25th birthday. And all she was doing was out celebrating her birthday. The cops tell so many lies, they change their quote-unquote narrative, their favorite word, of how people die. And there's no other place you can get that. Not even in war do you get stories changed of how people die. But they seem to feel that it's a joke and that they can, you know, people's lives are something to play with. They're not important. They don't matter. They don't have any value unless they assign it to them. And that's not true. Our children are our value by us. The mothers risk their lives to get them here. And then they have to try to survive losing them. And that's the most painful work in the world. I knew that I couldn't just fight for my daughter. I had to fight for everybody. I got together with some other family members in Detroit who lost their loved ones to police murder. Kimberly Davis, her son was killed in Ohio by an Ohio State trooper. Kevin Kellum, his son was killed by an ICE officer in Detroit. And Matilda Jones, her granddaughter Ayanna Jones was killed by a Detroit police officer. And we came together and decided we needed to fight for ours. We needed to get together with others like us and fight. And we created Pulse. Pulse is now 3 years old. We're in 5 different states. We're getting ready to open another chapter in Louisiana by the end of the year. But the fight is not just to get justice for our kids, it's to change the laws that govern the police officers so that we don't have to go through this. Accountability is for everybody. It's not just select few. And they feel like they don't have to be accountable for anything that they do. And not only do we strongly disagree with it, moralistically it's wrong that they even feel that they could do that.
So can you talk a little bit about how we can hold police officers more accountable for their actions?
First of all, we need to change the laws. When they commit a crime, they are to be treated just like everybody else. There's nothing special about them because they got a badge and a gun. That's an oath that they took that they don't give a damn about. So why did they get privileged from them? There should be nothing special held up for them. Also, prosecutors, your government, your state government accountable for the crimes in the process. In the process in which they use to handle these officers. Because in Detroit, we do a feet to fire act, which is what this is. I created that because we needed to make the prosecutor aware that we know that you're not doing your job. And the only reason that these cops are getting away with murder is because you refuse to prosecute them. Prosecute them for the crimes that they commit. Take away their peace officer's license. Don't let them resign.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what that peace officer's license is?
Yes. The peace officer's license is what allows a person to be an officer. And they can take that license anywhere they go. It doesn't matter what state issued it. As long as it's in standing, you can go somewhere else and work, whether it's in the same state or you go to a new state, as in with the officer who killed Tamir Rice. Took his peace officer's license from L.A., goes to Ohio. First thing he does is kill this little boy. But if you take away their peace officer's license, they can no longer be a cop. Most places, if they find out they were a police officer and they lost their peace officer's license, they won't even hire them to be a security guard over an empty warehouse. Just because that it says you are a high-risk problem.
And that was Shalonda McNair talking with KBOO's Kinsey Beard.
An Oregon man faces 15 years in prison for a hate crime targeting a Catholic church. 69-year-old Benjamin Jaramillo Hernandez is behind bars for threats, intimidation, and illegally possessing ammunition, according to the Department of Justice. It says he committed a hate crime targeting St. Mary Catholic Church in Eugene. Court documents say on September 9, 2018, Hernandez was escorted from St. Mary following an angry outburst. 5 days later, a church employee reported to the Eugene police that someone dispensed pepper spray on door handles and through a mail slot of the St. Mary office. Employees reported burning sensations in their fingers and respiratory distress. A Eugene police officer and FBI agent identified Hernandez in surveillance footage as the person responsible. On September 16th, Hernandez was again spotted near St. Mary. A witness saw him across the street from the church shouting, quote, "I've got something for you right here," while pointing to a bag he was carrying. A few days later, St. Mary employees reported finding a threatening note and 7 bullets in their office. U.S. Attorney Billy Williams of the District of Oregon says, quote, "Mr. Hernandez used intimidation and threats of violence to terrorize a single congregation, but the harm from hate crimes like this extends beyond the specific individuals or group targeted."
Robocalls to people in Washington State are picking up, so AARP has launched a new campaign urging people not to fall for their scams. Washingtonians received almost 560 million automated calls last year. Doug Shadle, State Director of AARP Washington, says harassing and threatening calls from people who say they're with the Social Security Administration or Internal Revenue Service are the most successful scams, according to this new survey.
Some of them are positive messages, like you've won money, and some of them are these fear-based tactics. And what we found is that significantly more people respond to the fear tactics than to the promises of wealth. And so that's really disturbing. Caller ID is no longer a reliable way to determine who's on the phone because it's so easy to spoof the number, to just make up a number to make it look like it's local when it's not.
And so AARP, Microsoft, the Federal Trade Commission, and the credit union BECU launched a campaign called Spoof Proof Your Life, heading across the state to help people spot and stop these scams. Now, according to the group survey, 3 in 5 Washingtonians say they're more likely to pick up calls from a local area code, and almost half are willing to pick up calls from an area code where friends or family live. Along with no longer relying on caller ID, AARP Washington also suggests that folks use call blocking services like NomoRobo or UMail, verify the identity of the person calling, and report any fraud to the Federal Trade Commission or the State Attorney General.
The owners of the Bend Bulletin newspaper are dissolving the company and selling all 7 newspapers in its Pacific Northwest chain and 2 in California. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports today that Western Communications' plan was revealed in federal bankruptcy court yesterday. OPB reports this week's court filing indicates the company is negotiating with, quote, a short list of buyers. The company filed Chapter 11 in January and said at the time it was working to strengthen its operations in Oregon and California. This week's documents for the first time indicate the company is planning to dissolve all of its Oregon assets. Western Communications is roughly $30 million in debt. The bankruptcy statement indicates 5 potential buyers have toured the Bulletin's facilities and engaged in negotiations. Western Communications owns the Bulletin as well as the Baker City Herald, the Curry Coastal Pilot, the La Grande Observer, and the Redmond Spokesman in Oregon. In California, the company owns the Daily Triplicate in Crescent City and the Union Democrat in Sonora.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on how the Pan-African Festival is branching out and getting into a business focus. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. And tonight's weather for you, rainy and 51 degrees out there. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy. We'll see highs around 63 degrees. And today in history, on this date in 1785, Ben Franklin announced his invention of bifocals. And our quote of the day is from Ben Franklin, who said this new creation helped him because, quote, "I wear my spectacles constantly. I have only to move my eyes up or down as I want to see distinctly far or near, the proper glasses being always ready.
There's bad news for Memorial Day beachgoers this year. After the Oregon Health Authority issued an advisory today for Dee River Beach in Lincoln City, recent water samples have high levels of fecal bacteria, and public officials are urging people to stay clear of the area while the advisory is in effect. Coming in contact with the water could cause symptoms like stomach cramps, respiratory infections, and rashes. Health advisories are not uncommon at Dee River Beach. Most recently, there was a warning for the area in September. While this comes at a particularly bad time, local beaches are not affected. Neither are neighboring beaches near there.
As local crews work to control mosquitoes, they're encouraging everyone to take steps to eliminate the bugs' habitats and avoid their bites. This spring, Clark County Mosquito Control District crews monitored floodwater areas and wetlands, which are common mosquito breeding areas. Their samples show significant numbers of mosquito larvae, with the potential for as many as 8 million mosquitoes per acre. Over the next several days, the Mosquito Control District will use a helicopter to treat 800 to 1,000 acres of floodwater areas and wetlands. The treatment will cover areas between Ridgefield and the area south of Vancouver Lake. It will not affect residential areas. The treatment uses a naturally occurring soil bacteria that kills mosquito larvae in water. Now, you can help prevent mosquitoes from breeding on your property by taking these simple steps. Drain standing water from old tires, flower pots, buckets, plastic tarps, and wheelbarrows. Change water in bird baths, ponds, wading pools, pet bowls, and animal troughs twice a week. Repair leaking faucets and sprinklers. Clean clogged gutters. Check for containers or trash in hard-to-see places, and report standing water to the Mosquito Control District. And to avoid mosquito bites, install or repair screens on windows and doors. Wear long-sleeved shirts, long pants, shoes, socks, and hats outside, especially in wooded areas. Place mosquito netting over infant carriers when outdoors, and use EPA-registered insect repellents, especially at dawn and dusk. The mosquito season usually runs through the end of September.
Thinning forests, is it really the answer to our wildfire problems in the Pacific Northwest? Not so fast, says longtime forest activist Kathy Seitz. Here she is with this commentary for the KABU Evening News.
Due to recent fire intensity, there has been a push to address the problem of wildfires by thinning our forests. This is not the way to go. The Forest Service claims that science supports this approach of thinning, but many scientists do not agree. The main problem with thinning a forest, they say, is that if you expose too much of the ground, the moisture in it will evaporate, and you will increase, not reduce, the risk of the forest burning. Additionally, the larger a tree is, the more resistant it is to fire. Very large or old-growth forests can have a fire go through them and remain standing quite easily. The size of the trees also makes them a break in the wind, and they store huge amounts of water inside their trunks. Yet, unbelievably, the BLM and Forest Service continue proposing to thin in areas with huge trees. Also, some so-called thinning treatments look not much better than a clear cut. Even where trees are smaller and appear very crowded, they could be left alone, as thinning may be done naturally by wind or insects. We are going to have to deal with fires whether we thin or not. Right now, fires which naturally occur in our forests have been suppressed for many years. This means they are more frequent because there is more to burn. Letting the wild country return to a natural burning cycle will take a while. The only way to truly stop that would be to cut down everything. Environmental organizations are doing good work on this and other problems. BARC is looking for volunteers on issues regarding Mount Hood. Get involved. I also recommend Oregon Wild and the Sierra Club, both of which have events in other cities as well. Check their websites for more information. This is longtime forest activist Kathy Seitz.
16-year-old climate change activist Greta Thunberg penned a call to action today, urging adults to take part in Friday's strike for climate change happening all across the world. The Swedish teenager is at the forefront of the climate change movement and inspired more than 1.4 million young people to engage in school strikes for climate change last March. In her call to action, Thunberg directs her attention to adults and encourages them to stand in solidarity with the young protesters tomorrow by joining them. Thunberg said yesterday, quote, "This is not a single generation job, it's humanity's job." Thunberg asked for adults to join the climate change strikes happening tomorrow, Friday the 24th.
A tornado ravaged Missouri's capital, Jefferson City, late last night. The storm killed at least three people. With winds reaching highs of 160 miles per hour, the tornado ranked in the top 5% of all storms in terms of damage. First responders worked into the early hours of the morning in their efforts to rescue trapped individuals, but the scope of damages and injuries is not yet known. Jefferson City police report emergency workers brought at least 20 residents to local hospitals. The tornado hit follows a severe weather outbreak across the area earlier this week.
The country of Botswana announced it's lifting its ban on elephant hunting, citing a rise in, quote, human-elephant conflict as a result of increasing elephant numbers in the area. Botswana has the world's largest population of elephants, home to an estimated 130,000 of them. Tourism related to the elephants is the country's second largest foreign income earner. Elephant hunting was outlawed in Botswana in 2014 by former president and conservationist Ian Khama and has long since been a site of refuge for the species along the Ivory Coast. Conservationists worry that the lifting of the ban could result in an increase of deaths related to selling ivory, a practice that is outlawed. The lifting of this ban follows the election of Mugwesi Masisi, who won the presidency by appealing to rural voters. Don Pinnock, a conservation journalist and author, told reporters, quote, "An elephant is killed by poachers on average every 15 minutes. This is a tragedy." The elephant population is considered vulnerable, down between 3 to 5 million of them in the last century. Many say unregulated hunting is to blame. And Zulu Summer is a documentary on how a community radio station in Butte, Montana, almost accidentally forged a lasting relationship with a community radio station in Ngoma, South Africa. The film plays tonight at the Portland Art Museum at 7 p.m. KBU Sean Stewart spoke with a radio DJ who made it all happen.
So, hey, this is Sean Stewart. I'm sitting here with Dark Sevier. He's from the radio station. He's affiliated with the radio station KBMF.
Right. I am the former music director for KBMF LP Butte, a little 100-watt station in Butte, Montana.
Fantastic. And how long have you been there?
Well, I moved to Butte in 2014 when they began the process of trying to start the station. We flipped our switch on June 1st, 2015. So I got to be there for the outset, the beginning, the setup of the radio station. I got to be there for the first three sexy years where nobody's listening and you can get away with everything. So I was there for the first 3 years of the station.
Oh, that's great. And the story is that you received what was thought to be a spam email.
Well, the radio station, as I said, was new. We're just trying to acquire some listeners. The email was fairly unattended, and we did get a email or a message, a Facebook message from a African prince who said that he had a radio station and wanted to do a cultural exchange, share information, share programming, which I immediately thought, sure, you do. And I assumed he was running some kind of scam. So I decided to play with him for a while and scam him. So I thought I would walk him along fairly normally and then throw him some right hooks and curves, see if he was going to swerve or give up. Or this went on for about 3 days. And the more I tried to throw him, the less successful I was. Just before the Clark and Dark show, which I was doing at the time on Thursday nights, I told him I was going to make a show for him to broadcast on his station, thinking it wasn't real. And then about 20 minutes before we went on the air, the station manager at KBMF said, I looked at the government website, and that's a real prince, and he really has a radio station. So we went live that night, and halfway through our show, they flipped the switch, and we were broadcasting live at 7 a.m. in South Africa to 70,000 bewildered Zulus.
Wow. that's a remarkable story. And so then what happened afterwards?
Well, we had a morning show in South Africa. the idea of Prince Sibusiso Zulu, who was the station manager for Nongoma FM, which synchronistically also started, they flipped their switch on June 1st, 2015, the same day we did on the other side of the planet. None of us knew that until we started talking to each other. His goal was to create a global community radio network. He wanted to connect small independent stations all over the world in order to learn from each other, learn how they can do their station better, learn how the town that has the station does things, because they're really aspiring to make themselves into young entrepreneurs. The unemployment rate in South Africa is, or in Zululand, is about 70,000 for the youth. So 70,000, or 70%. So 70% youth unemployment rate. So there's no place to just go get a job. So there, the radio station was started to empower the kids to learn how to get from high school to college, deep rural kids that had no other media to listen to, and to help kids that are going to college and getting out of college to find ways to be entrepreneurs. So this radio collaboration with other stations around the world was for them to try to find some tools on how to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and learn lessons from people around the world. And we just happened to be the first stop on his world domination tour.
That's fantastic. The world domination tour, radio community alliances.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys got in touch with me. I think it was Terry Briggs, as a matter of fact.
Right, right.
She'd contacted me and talked to me about having Prince come here. And I think that was in September or October.
Last year, right. Yeah. So the Zulus, they, after communicating back and forth with them and broadcasting on their station for an hour a day from our station, we decided to move ahead. I had invited him to stay on my couch when I thought he was a Nigerian scammer. And then when I found out he was a real prince, we followed through. We're like, well, come on out. So the three gentlemen spent the entire summer of 2017 in Butte, Montana. And that spawned, when I found out that was happening, we were able to manifest a documentary crew from Los Angeles to film a lot of key segments of their stay in Butte, Montana. And that resulted in the Zulu Summer documentary.
So how did you conjure up the crew from Los Angeles?
Well, a gentleman who had lived in Portland, Don Andrews, he had worked with film festivals here in town. We started our own film. He started his own film festival in Butte, Montana, called the Covalite International Film Festival. Some folks from New York came out, had a good time, went back to New York, started telling people about Butte, Montana. So a producer called Don and said, "What's interesting in Butte, Montana?" And Don also works at KBMF. He's one of the DJs on the community radio station. He said, "Well, we have this radio station with this strange Prince connection." And so she jumped on an airplane and did a sort of sizzle reel, interviewed myself and Clark and a few people around town, and managed to connect with Joseph Litzinger from Interesting Human Media in Los Angeles. He's also the producer for Life Below Zero, which is a Nat Geo show. They decided it was a worthy project, and even though they were in the midst of finishing their first independent documentary film, because of the time sensitivity of this, they decided to take on this project as well. So no budget. The camera guy came out and was moonlighting from his day job with Life Below Zero. We just started shooting from the hip and trying to document what we could, because how often does a Zulu prince land in Montana?
Right. Yeah. So this is a tour. The you're touring with the. I guess what I'm asking is, so this show in Butte, it's showing in Portland on Thursday.
Right.
And then are you going to Seattle? You're visiting other cities in the area?
The film was just, we had our world premiere at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival in February. They were the first one to accept us, and that's where we got our world premiere. Butte was, we decided to slate that for last week, last Saturday. It debut to Montana because we already have distribution. So by summer, the movie will be available on Amazon and iTunes, and I guess they're going to work towards trying to get it on PPS or Netflix or whatever they do digitally to for streaming and for buying the physical copy. So now that we have distribution, we're working on the notion of an educational tour, because the movie's a feature-length film. It's an hour and 18 minutes or so. But it's 12 terabytes of footage that had to be whittled down to an hour and a half. Mm. So there was a lot of stuff covered in that summer that couldn't fit in the film. And because the Prince's idea of starting this community radio network around the world, the idea of the movie or the tour for me is more educational. So it's showing the film, showing what the power of a 100-watt station was able to accomplish with a nation on the other side of the planet, and try to figure out what else we can do now that we have the the bully pulpit of a film. So going from radio to film is sort of enabling us to shine a spotlight on the importance of community media. The importance of outlets where people can see and hear themselves in their town instead of having to tap into some pipeline from, you know, some corporate office in New York. So the Q&A is really about developing relationships with community media in the places such as KBOO here in Portland. When we had the debut in Santa Barbara, the house manager for the theater was at the film festival, had no idea what the film was. Danny Ramirez at KZAA, Kazaa in Santa Barbara, brand new low power station. He had no idea what the movie was. He saw it. He's the station manager for his station. So the next day after that premiere, we went to KZAA and talked about the movie. And for us, it's about building awareness of the importance of community radio, community media, and getting a chance to share this movie. And we have other programs that we are trying to develop from this, in this relationship between the Zulu Nation and Butte, Montana, as sort of we're looking at as the starting point for relationships with other media organizations around the world.
You're one of the executive producers for the film, is that correct?
Correct.
And so are you involved in public access television or anything like that in Butte?
Well, I was with KBMF. Because they're a brand new station, you know, we started working at the station for free until we were able to make enough money to maybe get a stipend for ourselves. Myself and Clark, we were the two first paid staff members at the station. And as the years went on, work became more laborious, and a small station in a small town didn't have a huge donation base. So at the time I quit, I was working about 30 hours a week for $500 a month, and that just became unsustainable. So they've had to split that duty. They're actually growing. They've built their own news team in the last 3 years, which is amazing. That was sort of a dream in the beginning that we could do that, and now they have people doing environmental reporting and local news, as well as airing Native American news and other independent sources from around the country.
So could you give us some more information about the movie? It's airing Thursday.
Right. From what I understand, there will be a reception at the Witzel Auditorium, which is at the Portland Art Museum. So there's a reception at 6 where we can talk story a little bit before the movie, and then the screening is at 7 p.m. So that's what I know. I haven't been to the theater. I haven't been to the museum. We literally just got out of the car from driving in from Montana. So we're looking to get oriented, talk to some folks around town, connect with some friends that I have here in town, and then go see a movie. And after the movie, there will be a Q&A with myself and one of the editors from the film, who I believe lives here in Portland. So we're going to do the movie and a Q&A. It should be a fun time, good event. It's a fairly positive film and dark times in our culture right now. So it sort of bucks the narrative that you have to have something terrible happen for people to pay attention.
And again, this is Sean Stewart speaking with Dark Sevier of Butte, Montana, KBMFLP.
That's right. 102.5. You can actually stream us live like the Zulus do at butteamericaradio.org.
And there you have it, folks. For the KBOO Evening News, this is Sean Stewart.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Dart.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 23rd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kenzie Beard, Ron Bede, and Kathy Seitz. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Randall Rigo. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is myself, Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Annette Newell. Stay right here with us. KBOO News In Depth is coming up in just a moment.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to KBOO News In Depth. The Pan-African Festival is branching out. Starting 3 years ago with the cultural celebration in Pioneer Square, now the organization is hosting the Black Business Summit, coming up June 1st at Portland State University. KBOO's own Lisa Loving spoke with founder Nafisa Fai about the definition of Pan-Africanism and why the group's new business focus is so important.
For people that are new to the term, what do you mean by Pan-African?
Good question, and thank you for having me. And I think that's the term that really made us have a lot of conversation. So I think of the people that are confused, they're not alone. I think this journey started back in 2016 when we wanted people to sort of come together and do economic development through celebrations. And we didn't know what to call that celebration, so that Black businesses and that we have, we built some engines that play a role in Oregon's economy. So how do we define Pan-African? The idea is really to have everyone who identifies as somewhere from Africa. I hate to say, like, but Caribbeans, African Americans, Africans, Afro-Latinx, you know, not just skin color, but beyond that, anybody from the diaspora really is Pan-African, is what we're talking about, is anybody, Black Americans, Black foreigners, Caribbeans, Afro-Latinx. And so, yeah.
So now talk a little bit about the organization. What need do you fill?
The Pan-African Festival is an organization dedicated to creating new opportunities for historically marginalized communities in Oregon. We focus on really just bringing and being an added value to Oregon and Oregon's economy and to the Black community here. So we're really about galvanizing, mobilizing, and empowering the community, bringing people in, fulfilling deficits that exist in the Black community.
Okay, the third annual Pan-African Festival itself is coming up in August, but closer than that is the Black Business Summit. It's the first one ever, and you're partnering with the Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon, so they're all about the nuts and bolts of small business best practices. So what's going to happen at this event, first ever? Am I getting that right?
Yes, we're really excited. Exciting. Yeah, we're very excited for this. And, you know, to give a little bit history of how the Black Business Summit came about is that in the past 2 years, Pan-African Festival of Oregon, as an organization, we've been hosting the first, you know, the annual festival that happens in the Pioneer Square. Last year was our second year, and through partnership with TriMet, we found out that 13,000 people came. So it was really successful, and we had 15 Black-owned businesses that day that participated, and they had 3,000 people that bought something from them. So it was really successful, and the year before as well was really a big hit, but that was the first year, and there was a lot of legwork that was done to really promote and do. We did a lot of educational campaigns to get the word out, to educate what is a Pan-African, who's in there, what are we trying to do, what's the value, you know, to everyone involved, both the community that identify within this community, and then also the allies and supporters. So through those years, a lot of the businesses and others who didn't get the opportunity to participate in the festival because we're limited with space have been asking us to do more. Really, because, you know, they're like, you guys are successful, you know, you get bigger space, do more. And we really didn't know what we could do more. I mean, there's a lot we could do, but we're limited with fundings. We're a volunteer-based organization. Not a lot of people know us, especially funders. But we're doing great work, and the work speaks itself. But it's just when people don't know you, it's hard to get those resources. So we heard our businesses, our partners, and people who, you know, we heard people who said, I really wanted to participate, but you guys rejected me because of your space limitations, but I want you to do more and more. So in order to heal the community and everybody and to say, we heard you, we decided that we will do something for Black businesses. And one thing that people have, you know, want is something that is really gathering the Black business community, because there isn't an attention or focus, which also leads to lack of investments to the Black community business, the Black business community, I think is a better way to say it, but so we decided that, you know, in order to elevate this problem and to bring attention to the and to really have conversations and debates about solving the root cause of this lack of investment to the Black community, we decided that we need to gather at a, you know, this is a critical moment in, you know, politically, financially. There's a lot of stuff that are happening, hurtful stuff. So we decided that we need to gather together as a community and, you know, not cry over spilled milk, but do things for ourselves and move the needle in our own terms, in our own way. So we decided to host the Black Business Summit in Oregon. We decided to do that. And we don't do business development ourselves. We're just an up-and-coming, and we're really a grassroots organization, and we're predominantly young. So we decided that, you know, the organizations that do these types of work, why not partner? So we reached out to MISO and said, hey, you know, we are interested in doing this. Do you want to go to this journey with us? And that's been a really positive interaction. And that's how they got on board and got involved in what we're trying to do. And we also have a great other partners. We have a Black fraternity that's also part of the festival and really a key players as well, who, you know, we're going to do workshops at the Black Business Summit because we want to eliminate this, you know, the professional tools that are needed. And we really are hoping our ultimate goal with the summit is to create pathways to resources, because right now a lot of us in the business world, there are tons of resources that exist, but we don't know how to access. So how can we create, in a culturally competent way, pathways to those resources? Because it isn't, there are tons of resources that we're not accessing.
Nafisa,
Why is business development an important priority for the Pan-African Festival and the state overall? Why that specific thing?
That's a really good question. I think for us, it was sort of the push from our own business community telling us to do more, because we're really good at generating revenue, creating platforms that generate revenues for these businesses. So that's how it came up. But I think the importance of having business development, and especially focusing on the Black business community, is because this is a community that have been in, you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, have been overlooked, right? Like, as a community, there isn't sort of like this movement there to create these spaces that really develop these businesses. There's spaces that exist currently that are best practice that I wish we could replicate for the Black community. For example, the Portland Mercado. You know, as there was a great vision that I started, it was a big vision, great big vision that distilled to Mercado Portland today. But how can we replicate even that small to the Black community? Because we don't really have a space for Black businesses to come. And, you know, wouldn't it be ideal? And this is a story and a thing we've been saying for the past 3 years. And one day, large institutions will just hear us, hopefully, instead of just having this savior complex and wanting to do things themselves, letting that community just sort of be their own saviors and do things. But I feel like business development is really crucial, and I recommend every organization that works in the Black community and improving the conditions of the Black community to really take up on a role in that, to just build power economically, because we're not powerful players, but we do have the numbers and we have the culture of supporting of our own kind. How could we just keep that and just let everybody from where they are on that building can hear?
So who do you hope will come to the Black Business Summit, which is June 1st?
The Black Business Summit is June 1st. We're hoping... We only have a space for 65 people, first of all, I should say. And we're hoping out of those 65 people, 50 of them to be Black business owners. So right now we're in the process of selling the tickets, and it's on our Facebook and our website as well, for anybody who wants to attend, who's a business owner. But the idea is really to have... all those 65 people will be aspiring or business owners, and really will be powerful, because this is, and we said 65 because we want to do it well, because we know we can grow. And as a Pan-African Festival, as an organization, we know what it takes and we have the expertise to bring large crowds out. But we wanted to do it well and invest in these 50 Black business owners, and then the other 15 to be people who support the rise of the Black community businesses.
Okay, back to the Pan-African Festival itself, which is coming up in August. That event is celebrated for bringing together all kinds of different people in Pioneer Square, right? I mean, I was amazed when I've gone to that event a couple of times. What are your plans for this August?
We're so excited. This is going to be our best year so far. I think we've learned a lot. We've accumulated a lot of lessons learned in the past that we're going to do some improvements to it. And we're really excited. It's going to be bigger and better, hopefully. And we have an amazing young man, Letevin, who's handling, who's the director of the entertainment. And he just really just been working really hard to bring great talent and great, amazing entertainment. So I'm really excited about the entertainment piece about this year, as well as, and we're going to have, you know, the market is still going to be open. So we're going to have our Black-owned businesses that are going to be participating. We're going to have some partners who are going to be tabling. We're also going to have our volunteers, and then we're excited to celebrate with the larger. We're hoping to have at least 15,000 people, TriMet tell us, to come in. And we know that about 50,000 people come into downtown that every day, approximately. So I think we can get those 15,000 people, and it's just celebrate and join us to experience the culture.
Okay, now back to the Black Business Summit. If someone's listening right now, we've been talking about it, but what do they need to do to participate with you at that event? Anyone listening right now, what should they be doing?
They should go to our website, which is www.panafricanfestival.org. The OR stands for Oregon, .org. And we've got tons of information, what the Black business is, what the idea, what the goal is, and how it came about, you know, the disparity that led to the encouragement from the businesses that really brought the Black Business Summit. And it's going to be June 1st at 7:30 a.m. because it's that early because these are business people and time is money. So we're doing it early so they can get out early at 2 o'clock and be done with it and had, they could say that this added value to my life. And it's going to be at Portland State. If people want to register, we have tickets are on sale right now. It's on our Facebook, Pan African Festival of Oregon. I think it'll come up. It's also on our website. It's also on Eventbrite. If you go to Eventbrite and Google Black Business Summit. But we encourage everybody to join us, be part of this. And, you know, we hope to do this the next 50 years. So let's, you know, when we retire, so we can say we were there for the first one. Join us.
Nafisa Fai, Pan African Festival of Oregon Black Business Summit. Thanks for coming in today and talking.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So I enjoyed it.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Members of a tribe are helping Washington State University research the impact of cannabis. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with today's report from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Each graduation season, reports pop up of Native American high school students being prohibited from wearing an eagle feather, beaded cap, or other traditional items to graduation. Recently in Arizona, a student was turned away from her graduation ceremony for trying to enter the stadium with a beaded cap. A recent North Dakota law guarantees Native students the right to wear eagle feathers. And as Taylor Stagner reports, some students and their families are seeking a policy for Native students in a Wyoming school district.
Native students and educators alongside Albany County School Board in Wyoming are coming up with a policy to protect beadwork and feathers on graduating seniors' caps. Currently, there are no guidelines either way. While there are no rules against it, concerned students and parents of graduating seniors would like their beadwork protected. Alexis White Rock graduated from Big Piney High School in 2016. White Rock is Navajo and Shoshone Paiute. White Rock was told she could not bead her graduation cap.
I asked the principal, I was like, well, it's kind of part of my culture and everybody on my family on my parents' reservation zoo. And I was really hoping if I could bead my cap and put a feather on it, and they said no. And there was no way they were going to allow me to at all. And they said if I did, they would take my cap away from me.
This new policy in Albany County would protect people like White Rock's right to bead their caps and wear feathers, a tradition that is cultural and personal. Huda Curry Herrera is a graduating senior and a prominent basketball player at Laramie High School. Curry Herrera spoke in front of the school board earlier this month and wanted to be a voice for Native kids that are not seniors yet.
Felt good to represent not only me, but like the years behind me and all my friends. Like, it felt cool knowing that me and my mom and Dr. Jaime were the ones behind it all.
Curry Herrera and other Native graduates have been told that they are allowed to bead their caps and wear feathers at LHS's graduation in May. Jubal Yenny is the superintendent of Albany County School District Number 1, and he says he is optimistic about the policy.
It's not a hard request. I mean, I think the school board is very in favor of trying to make this work.
The school board is expected to pass the policy this summer. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
A Muscogee Creek Nation casino in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was closed Wednesday because of flooding. Hotel guests were relocated and employees of the River Spirit Casino Resort were sent home due to rising levels of the Arkansas River. Casino management issued a statement which said it was the best decision to protect people. Other Oklahoma tribes are also dealing with flooding. The Cherokee Nation's Marshal Service and emergency managers spent Wednesday helping tribal citizens in flood zones. According to the tribe, about 164 Cherokees live in the Fort Gibson flood zone, which could be impacted by flooding. The tribe has food and water ready for distribution, and shelters are set up. While the Chickasaw Nation was on a tornado watch, and leaders urged tribal citizens to tune into their community radio station for updates. State leaders are assessing storm damage and are reminding people as flooding continues and could worsen to be prepared and use safety measures. Researchers at Washington State University are teaming up with the Puyallup tribe to study medical cannabis and its impacts on pain, physical and mental health, and if it reduces opioid use. The clinic serves clients at a natural healing and research center, which helps patients with cannabis therapies and other natural lifestyle choices. It's open to both native and non-native patients. The tribe is also involved in the recreational cannabis industry in the state with the ownership of two stores. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
He said, well, I think you better get out of Vanport as quick as you can. He said, the dike is broke, and he said, Vanport's going to be underwater before long.
At 4:17 p.m. on the 30th of May, the makeshift railroad dike holding back the Columbia River broke. In no more than 10 minutes, Vanport was 6 feet underwater.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, taking place now through June 5th in North and Northeast Portland. On Monday, May 27th, there will be a memory activism fair, which includes exhibits, listening stations, and artifacts from Vanport. Other events include documentary screenings of the Vanport Mosaic Oral History Project and Japanese Americans Beyond the Wire, walking tours, and more. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, taking place now through June 5th in North and Northeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of My Story, My Superpowers.